Hello out there, everybody. It's Movie Geeks United. Tonight, the majority of our show will be dedicated to the art of the movie poster. This is a topic that we really haven't explored with much depth in the past 7 years of our show's history, so this will be a good topic of discussion, I think. And part of that discussion will be an interview with a director by the name of Eric Sharkey, who has a new film out about Drew Struzan, probably amongst the most famous of movie poster illustrators out there. That movie titled Drew, the man behind the poster, is now available on DVD.
You know, it is said that the art and craft of filmmaking is collaborative. So to be singled out and rewarded tonight means that that is not true. Is it my imagination, or is this year's Oscar ceremony a little on the cheap side?
Last night was the honorary Oscars. The recipients included Steve Martin, Angela Lansbury, and Angelina Jolie.
And the other one was the costume designer Mario Tosi. So he's the first costume designer to win an honorary Oscar. So that's interesting.
I like how it's structured now with the honorary Oscars as a separate ceremony. I know a lot of people feel it's a pretty foul feeling about it because it cheats them of the main stage on Oscar night. But they're all acknowledged on main Oscar night. They get up and take a bow. But what this new format allows is for them to actually have time in an intimate setting to express appreciation and to be appreciated. That's what it's all about.
I agree. And I watch, you know, now that they've done it as a separate ceremony, I watch it, you know, every year. And it's kind of like a nice kind of entryway into the award season in some ways. It's sort of like a mini Oscar all its own, you know, but it's more intimate, obviously. And it gives, like as you said, you know, it gives greater time not only for the participants to get up there and speak, or the winners to get up and speak, but also just the tributes that come from. I mean, last night the Steve Martin tribute from Martin Short and from Tom Hanks and few other people up there, you know. I think it's nice. I think it is better, you know. I mean, yeah, it doesn't get a billion people eyes on it, you know, like the Oscars does. But so what? I mean, it's really about celebrating these people.
Hello, hello. Hey. Tell me why I'm in here. Look at me. No.
Get that heart rate. The body of Donna Hawthorne was discovered. The crime suspect, Joseph Doucette, the victim's former husband and father of the surviving child.
My father's been missing for 20 years. If I could somehow bring him here, do you think you could forgive him?
I could try.
The audience at the screening of Spike Lee's Old Boy squirmed about in the AMC Lincoln Square Center from the graphic violence, but the film's climactic twist moved many to audible discomfort. I've never been more shocked and surprised by an ending since maybe The Sixth Sense, says Elizabeth Olsen, who plays a character in the film.
I wonder if this ending is any different from the ending for the original, because, you know, I mean,
I think it is.
I would imagine it is. I mean, if this is what's going on, I can't imagine people involved with it or to any knowledge of the original. You know, it sounds like he's, and I applaud him for doing that, because anything that would be different would be, I think, a step in the right direction.
But, I mean, you know, the original has a pretty, you know, the twist in the original film is pretty it's pretty stunning in and of itself. So,
yeah.
I'm just wondering if there are a lot of people who, if the thing is the same, and maybe there's just a lot of people who haven't seen the original.
Well, I'm going to go on the assumption that a lot of people have not seen the original. I would be willing to bet that people going in, you're going to have two kinds of people going into this film. Those who've seen the original and obviously those who haven't. And those who haven't will, I think, be the greater number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love the original film. I put it, it's one of my all-time favorite films. I also think it has one of the greatest sequences ever put to film, the hammer fight sequence. But having said that, let's be very honest. So this is not the original is not a mainstream film. It is not something that a lot of people have seen. When it opened up here, it played for a week and a half in downtown. And it's one of the few films that I went out of my way to see. But let's be very honest, this is not a mainstream film as far as American moviegoers are concerned. They, of course, will go, people have gone back and watched the film, I'm sure, especially since they've announced the remake. I'm sure a lot of people have gone back and watched the original film. But even with those numbers, this is opening, they made the same mistake with Killing Them Softly. They from a mid-October opening to a late November opening, they're going against Frozen, which is just, I wouldn't want to go against Frozen.
I don't want to go against Frozen. That's good counter-programming. You could say that,
I don't even know if counter-programming exists anymore, Dean. I just wouldn't want to go against Frozen. I wouldn't want to go against anything where I can make the whole family to go.
Let me just say this. The Old Boy is coming out in only 500 theaters. Whereas Frozen
only
is coming out in like 3,000. Hold on. Frozen is coming out in 4,000 theaters. So there's absolutely no way I don't look at Gold Boy as going up against Frozen and is actually trying to like vie to become number one, because there's no way you can become number one
with 500. In that it has major competition. Now forget that. It has major competition in Homefront. Wouldn't you say Homefront is the? Let's be very honest. You're going against Jason Statham and James Franco, and I don't.
Well,
regardless of what you think about them,
Homefront is going out into 2,000 theaters nationwide. This Old Boy is getting a sort of art house release, 500 theaters.
That's odd to me. I didn't know it was only 500.
500, really?
Well, they're trying to. I guess I don't know what their thing is. I guess they're looking at it as an art house movie, and as it does come from an art house source. I guess that's in some ways, and not only that, but also, a kind of an art housey director. He can be either art housey like with Red Hook Summer, or he can be mainstream like Inside Man or something like that.
Yeah, but wait a second. This is they are going on the assumption it's Red Hook Summer.
Got a much smaller release, but I
gotta be honest, Dean. What is it? All right, it's 500 theaters. The following weekend, you have Out of the Furnace comes out December 6th. I don't care how good Old Boy is, even if Vincent Canby comes back from the dead and says it's the greatest film ever made. You're going to compete this weekend. Case in point, you should have released Old Boy this weekend. You really should have put Old Boy
I agree because this weekend is blah. Like the whole scheduling problem of getting all of these movies out. I mean, here we are, we're looking down the barrel of the new award season, and here we are, and you still can't go to a multiplex and see anything other. They're still playing, some are still playing Gravity, some are still playing Captain Phillips, but that's it. And then the rest of it is Freebirds and Thor on three screens, and it's absolutely absurd that it is November and adults still have a hard time going to a multiplex, at least, which
that's
is
what I was
really
telling
what
Jerry,
a lot of people, you know.
I was telling Jerry the same thing earlier today because I was like, you know, when are these Oscar contenders coming out to my area? I mean, totally confusing. When is Dallas Buyers Club going to be in town? When does it go wide? When does, you know, what's all of these platform releases, and it sounds like Old Boy might be an example of that, gets very confusing to people that actually care about it.
Yeah.
That are looking out for a firm release date when they can go out and see it and plan to see it, you know?
I mean, you know, Dallas Buyers Club opened here in Atlanta this weekend, but it's playing only in one theater, and it happens to be one of my least favorite theaters in town. It's always uncomfortable. It's always, like, extra heated and horrible and uncomfortable, and you can't breathe in there and stuff. But for some reason, they've got this – Viterra has
it
this some kind
like
of
urine.
Reputation. Why isn't Dallas Buyers playing club – Dallas Buyers Club playing at a multiplex. Why aren't they putting these movies at mainstream theaters? I mean, I just don't understand why the whole idea of having 16 screens in one place was to give people an opportunity to make wider choices. But there are no choices. They're not providing.
You hit on something, Dean, but you've also hit on something that Jamie and I were talking about earlier. You know, it's funny. It would be nice if Dallas Buyers Club had the same same release strategy as The Butler. But unfortunately, with the Dallas Buyers Club, which is, you don't have someone like Oprah behind it. You know, Oprah, you know, her name, for better or for worse, you know, it can guarantee, like, a larger release. And it sucks because a movie like Dallas Buyers Club, or Nebraska for that matter, should be, I think, in a couple more theaters.
Why is it Inside Llewyn Davis out yet? I mean,
well,
this has been in the conversation ever since Cannes. For God's sakes, it's been 8 months for this movie.
Let me ask you a question, because thinking of the Coen brothers and how consistently brilliant they have been throughout their careers, I think we can probably point to maybe two movies that weren't necessarily up to snuff. But their batting average is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
There's another filmmaker that I don't think has ever made a bad movie. And Jerry, you mentioned Nebraska. It's Alexander Payne.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree.
I agree with that. You can cut me off whenever you want to. I get into this argument with my mom because she and my one of my brothers are big fans of About Schmidt, but the book. But as you know, the movie of About Schmidt is very different from the book. Remember, Schmidt is a vile anti-Semite, a racist, and all this stuff, and they did water it down for the movie. I don't care what decade it is, you could not actually take Louis Begley Jr.'s character and do
really
an exact duplicate. You can't do that. I appreciated what they did. I was actually very touched because when I went into it, I didn't know anything that they had done anything. And I was like, actually, this works a lot better. Yes, my family, the only family of Jews alive, would have appreciated the anti-Semite, but it's not, that doesn't translate to ticket sales. That would have caused quite a stir. I really admire what Alexander Payne did to bring that to the screen. I really have to say, and I think is what's more commendable is Nicholson's performance, it doesn't get a lot of respect.
And it's really against type. It's against type.
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean,
and he completely changed his just the way he carries himself, the way he walks and everything with that sort of beaten down kind of quality. It was really a sort of a transformative performance from him,
beginning. Because it's somebody that, I mean, Jack is known as the most kind of effervescent, just eater of life that you can imagine. And in About Schmidt, he's playing a guy that is essentially invisible, which is an amazing compliment to him that performance worked. But, I love The Descendants, and I'm sure I'm going to love Nebraska, and I love Alexander Payne's earlier work, starting with Citizen Ruth. I love that movie. So funny and biting to me.
I just watched Citizen Ruth again recently, and it's still as great as it ever was. I still think the best, that and Election, are his two best movies. But I'm a huge fan of him, and the only movie of his that's kind of disappointed me was The Descendants, and that's not to say that it's a bad movie at all or something that I wouldn't recommend anybody to watch. I just don't think that it necessarily has quite that same kind of feel that Alexander Payne's previous movies do, but that's okay. I mean, that's fine. It's just not quite that sort of, he's biting is the right word for him, sort of bitter kind of, but with like an edge of sweetness. The Descendants has that to a certain extent, but not
I think
that,
it
not
has
as,
it.
I understand
but
what
you mean,
quite
though.
As bitter as the other movies are. But,
well,
the
material calls for something different. And I mean, The Descendants was one of my favorite movies the year it came out, and that movie breaks me up like few other movies can.
Mm-hmm.
It's just coded in this very mournful tone. I mean, it's a movie about loss. And I watched it several times since it came out, and I found that I can't watch it since my father had a stroke. It's too emotional for me, that movie. So I have a really.
Oh, it's a hard movie that way. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You're speaking of the wife, then yeah. Oh, totally. Mm-hmm.
But I was talking to Joe Hutching today. Who's an editor. He edited a lot of Oliver Stone stuff, and he edits a lot of Cameron Crowe stuff as well. He's the one that won an Oscar for JFK. So he's working on Cameron Crowe's new movie, and he wanted me to send him a link to the Richardson interview, and I did, and I wished him luck with the Cameron Crowe movie. And I love Cameron Crowe, but it got me to thinking. I typed to him. I said, whenever I need to be reminded of the good and the promise of humanity, I often turn to Mr. Crowe's films because they give me that warm feeling. I mean, a movie like Jerry Maguire, even We Bought a Zoo, has moments like that that just make you feel good about being a human.
Oh, yeah.
Let
me be honest. I mean, I think even though it's, derided, and even I was incredulous about Elizabethtown the first time I watched it. I've gone back and watched it. And, regardless of the film's notoriety in the years since it's come out, I think the speech that she gives to Orlando Bloom, where she says, yeah, you failed, so what? Don't let that get you down. I think whether Kirsten Dunst really exists in real life, or a character like that could exist in real life, is beside the point. I think it's a very inspiring movie. I know a lot of people hate it, but I think Elizabethtown is really one of those films I've gone back and really has grown on me.
His movies are the kind that are easily ridiculed because they're about people trying to find the best version of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's a great summary.
I think we so need that. There is absolutely not enough of that today.
I agree. I agree 100% with that statement. I think we're kind of okay, I think, and I'm saying that very facetiously, in terms of like letting people know about the horrors of the world. And I think we need more movies that are about the wonderful things in life. And maybe that's just me getting older and realizing, I think it's very attractive for younger people to discover the horrors of the world, particularly since they're coming out from their parents and they want to discover the world and maybe discover what they've been shielded from. And I think that's why a lot of younger people, I mean, always, younger people 20 years ago or whatever, when I was younger, I was very much interested in seeing movies that were very cynical. And as I've gotten older, I've discovered that I really want more movies now that are about, you know, people trying to be good and trying to do the right thing. And that's happening in the world. It's happening. So why shouldn't it be in the movies, you know?
There's actually been a study that was just released last week that the number of incidents of gun violence in movies has tripled since 1995, I think is the figure.
Oh, yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And the thing of it is, you know, there's such an age-old argument, the responsibility of showing violence in film. And my argument has kind of always been there's not enough violence in films. And this is what I mean by that. The violence that we're given are hundreds of people being mowed down in these big blockbusters. And some of them are really entertaining. But, you know, every franchise movie, tons of people are getting blown away and there's no consequence. What we need is more real violence in movies, something that shows the ugliness and the cost of violence, like a 12 Years a Slave, like a like a Boys in the Hood. I remember watching
Boys
in the
Hood. Well, we need to talk about Kevin.
Yeah, but I remember watching Boys in the Hood opening weekend, and the audience cheered at the violence at the end, and they failed to recognize that the movie's about the cycle of violence and how ugly it is and how much you lose when you engage in it. You know, it's not triumphant.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we were fed more of a diet of that kind of violence, then we'd recognize it for what it is, and it's not a thrill ride, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, as you said. Violence is treated as a way to goose the movie, goose the movie's energy level in some way.
Right. No,
and
of course.
I think sometimes that's what people are applauding, maybe. It's like, I'm suddenly jolted. Maybe that audience was suddenly jolted into out of this, some kind of stupor or something like that.
Right.
But it's interesting. I was just watching, I know you watched the show, Jerry, Bill Maher, and they had a guest on.
I fell asleep halfway through this episode.
Well,
you might have seen
this interview. The first interview they did was for a gentleman who's just written a book
about the militarization of police,
you know? Bill Maher asked the question, you know, why is it that police feel nowadays that they have to empty their clip into a suspect? What happened to just shooting somebody in the leg or something like that to stop them or whatever? And that's the reason for that is because police get into police work because they see it in something, and they see it in movies, and they see it. That's what they see. That's what they want. They want that movie kind of experience. They think that's exciting, and it's a way for them to have power. And in these movies that they love, they see cops emptying their whole clips into people.
Okay, let's get to our main topic. We've covered violence in movies and good-naturedness and all this kind of stuff. All right, our main topic of discussion tonight is the art of the movie poster, something that, like a lot of these things, I think, what we're discussing tonight, we've kind of lost sight of. They don't really do it anymore. The posters that we have now, for the most part, there are exceptions, of course, but for the most part, it's of a panel of the famous actors' faces just lined up on the movie poster and then stick the title on it, and that's it. Let me ask you this first of all. Has a movie poster ever convinced you to go see the movie?
Well, I mean, it does. It does. They do affect me. I mean, if I feel like there's been a certain level of creative power put into a movie poster, it tells me that there's a possibility that same kind of power has been put into the movie as well, and that the movie actually was good enough to inspire an artist to do something like that. Also, movie posters are incredibly informative to me personally and to other movie lovers who are geeky like me or like us, because I get to see the full
array of people involved with it. So, yes, the movie posters, you know, through the credits at the bottom. So the movie posters definitely, even bad movie posters definitely have some effect on me in terms of that. But, yeah.
They become so stale. So when you see a movie poster like that's extremely elegant, like, you know, in the same year we had The Insider, which is a great looking poster, and then we had American Beauty, that's become an iconic kind of image.
Mm-hmm.
Both very elegant posters. You know, it really catches your attention because it's unlike anything else that's being used to promote the movies at that time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Another problem with present day movie posters is this kind of like, I don't know when this kind of started, I guess, in the mid-90s, but really more like the early 2000s, like around Lord of the Rings time. They all have this sort of like dark brown or dark blue kind of look with shiny lens flares going on through and sort of silvery, and the art is sometimes accomplished. But they're kind of the same thing. There's like one central figure in there, or maybe half a face, or like you said, the long line of stars or whatever. But very few times is anybody coming up with anything that's just so striking. Like I remember the poster for Django Unchained last year was one of those that I said, oh, well, that's a great throwback to the whole Saul Bass kind of design of movie posters. And Tarantino could have easily put that whole array of stars on there, but instead he went with the chains and the silhouette of the two characters at the bottom and the red background and everything. And I thought but that kind of thing is happening so rare these days. It's getting better, but it could be a lot.
It makes me interested too. What shift happened, and is the involvement the director has after they've shot and delivered the movie? Does it
mm-hmm.
end there now? Is that more common where they have no say in how it's marketed? Because obviously they're there have been directors that are infamous for their meticulous involvement in every detail, like a Kubrick,
mm-hmm.
certainly. And I think left without their input, that the studios just fall back on the same old, same old.
Yeah. I mean, there's one big art designer, BLP Communications. And if you look them up on IMDb or IMP Awards, that's the International Movie Poster Awards, which is a great site if you're into movie posters. If you look up BFP Communications, you know, and you see they've done, you know, they've recently done, you know, those kind of great character posters for American Hustle, but they've also done Noah recently and you know, Anchorman 2, which is a good poster there, and
Look at their new poster for Nebraska, which is a black and white silhouetted profile of Bruce Dern. It's very stark and very striking.
That's one of the best posters of the year for sure. And Francis Ha, they did Francis Ha, which is another one of my favorite posters. Even outside of the fact that I like Greta Gerwig, I like the poster too. But most of their posters are kind of samey looking, you know. And I know from my experience over at TNT when I was working at Turner Network Television, that yes, the directors and the network itself had almost no input into the design of the posters that were done for Turner Network Television. They give it over to the agency. The agency delivers the poster back. The network does do some sort of market research in terms of focus groups and so forth, showing the posters to focus groups and then having them talk about, you know, what they like and don't like and whether this will make them watch the show or not. But other than that, the filmmakers are totally out of the loop on this. They're not involved at all. So, and I agree. I think that there needs to be more directors out there who are brave enough to actually stick their hand in there and say, no, this is the way it should be, you know.
Which is ridiculous. Test audiences are not graphic designers.
I've seen these focus groups before. I've seen videotapes of these focus groups where they talk about certain posters and everything. And they get so nitpicky and everything. I don't know. It doesn't... The typography doesn't look right or whatever. I don't know what I don't like about it. I just don't like it. But, you know, that's all they say, really.
Well, that's, because when you put normal average Joe in that position, it makes them all of a sudden feel empowered as some kind of false expert.
Authority.
Yeah, right.
Before I ask for specific poster titles from you guys, in general, what design elements do you respond most strongly to in a poster?
Well, I just wrote an article on filmicability, filmicability.blogspot.com, just a little thing there. But it's the lead article, my 200 favorite movie posters. And I basically said that the posters that I kind of look at them in two different ways. I said I most prefer posters that have a fine art, which transmits some of the story or what I think the story is going to be. B, make an intelligent use of color and negative space. That's very important. Negative space, very important to have some space for the image to breathe and not just trying to shove an entire movie into one image, you know, like they try and do. I like them when they're detailed, you know, and so I can, if I decide to hang it up, I can look at it over and over again. They have to be representing at least decent movies, you know, for me to go out and buy a movie poster or seek one out. But I look at, you know, the originality of the image, the color, sometimes the lack of color, the quality of the art, the typography, including the logo, the copy and the tagline is important, and also the layout and the placement of credits. All that stuff's very important to me.
I'm glad that you mentioned negative space, because that's the one element that I respond most to. In advertising, I love the use of negative space. That's why I'm so crazy about the Insider poster, or even a subpar movie, a subpar movie like The Mexican. Remember that movie?
But the poster,
Jerry, you're particularly fond amongst the group of new posters of the Mondo designs.
I think the Mondo posters are the greatest posters ever. I think the artwork of Tyra Scout and John Morcant and the rest of the guys who do these things are just incredible. I think the work, I posted a poster of the Big Lebowski on your page a couple weeks ago that I just love. I love the Tarantino, especially the Paul Thomas Anderson, the older films like the, I found one of Conquest of the Planet of the Apes last week that I just adored. I love the Mondo posters. I think it's one of the best things to happen to movie posters in a long time.
They maintain or bring back what we've been talking about, the artistic nature of them. But there's also a value, I think, and it's a trend now, of like going back to older movies and reinterpreting them into mm-hmm. like new art, which I find exciting. Because these are people that are excited about these movies, and they want to relive the movies by creating a new poster for them. I like that trend, actually.
I like the trend too. You know, I mean, I look at those posters not as I like movie posters because for me, I like posters that I imagine were at one time hanging up at the movie theater that was playing them. So that's kind of important to me. It's like having a movie poster is like having a little piece of the movie, you know, the movie going experience for me, and so I look at movie posters, you know, the traditional movie posters as being relics of advertising, and I like the Mondo movie posters a lot, But yeah. I don't really consider them necessarily real movie posters because they don't have – they're not advertising relics. So,
yeah, they're specialty
what
posters.
Really,
yeah,
they're specialty. They're art objects, really. I mean, you know,
but
when you go and buy
Alamo,
them –
for Alamo Draft House, though, they're very – they are big selling points, though. I mean, let's be honest. Alamo Draft House –
and they use them. They use them and hang them up and stuff. So in that realm or whatever, they are being used as actual advertising. So you're right about that. But since, you know, Alamo Draft House is really only in a couple of cities or whatever, I can't really, you know, comment on
that.
Well,
big collector's items, man. I mean, people, some of them go for over $1,000.
I wish I had one so I could sell it.
I've seen them, and let me tell you, I've been telling you, Jerry, but they have a series of like four or so posters that they've made for Carpenter's Halloween, and each of them.
Oh yeah! Oh god! Oh yeah!
Beautiful! Oh my gosh! Beautiful posters.
One more thing. I have to say this: the artwork on these posters is always magnificent. I mean, you know, I've very rarely seen one that said, "Ugh, I hate that one" or whatever. But what I really hope happens from this Mondo movie poster movement is that companies, film companies and directors and even advertising companies will see these and get inspired to do things like this for real movie posters, for like actual to emulate that sort of commitment to the artwork and to the passion, you know,
because we have lost
posters are passionless.
we've lost the illustration aspect of it. They're not artist drawn anymore. They're essentially a series of headshots on a poster.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, that's true. I found one on Tumblr earlier, Pacific Rim, that I really liked. But I also like there's one that re-envisioned the Star Wars trilogy as a spaghetti western, which I thought was really cool from a couple of years ago. But I can't wait. And you know what's going to happen for American Hustle? There are going to be awesome Mondo posters made for that. And I think Wolf of Wall Street. I think those two, we can honestly say that they'll probably be some really incredible Mondo interpretations of those that I look forward to.
Well, one other thing I have to say about the Mondo movement is that it really speaks to just only cult movies. So movies with strong cult followings, and those tend to be either fantasy, horror, sci-fi. Those are tops. And very rarely will you see a Mondo movie poster for anything that's outside of those.
You're right. You know, they're cult movies, but there's an artist, John Morcat, who does, and I hope that's his name. But he does them for Fight Club, TV shows, Breaking Bad, and Spartacus.
Those are all cult movies.
You know, I realize that, but A, he doesn't put the Big Lebowski, that's the ultimate cult, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
But you see them coming, and it's just amazing.
But
no one's gonna do one
for ordinary people or something like that.
I hope someone
does it after hearing you tonight.
I was just thinking, I wonder what the Mondo poster for A Woman Under the Influence would look like.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Why wouldn't you do that? Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they need to get – that's one thing. Is there, I feel like the Mondo movie poster movement is kind of stuck in that realm of, okay, well, I mean, obviously what they want to do is sell some movie posters, obviously, but – and so they have to speak to what movie posters are representing movies that people absolutely love and will trip over themselves to pay $1,000.
Right.
Whatever. But I would like to see them try and tackle something that's maybe not so popular. And maybe if they did a Mondo movie poster of Woman Under Influence or Ordinary People, maybe those would become cult movies too. Maybe a whole new audience would come to those things. So that's something they need to think about, you know, I think.
Well, let me tell you what I have in my living room. I have 31 posters. You know, some of these posters are not amongst my favorites, but I decided, you know, at a certain point, I was like, you know, I'm going to fill my environment with posters of all the movies that are my favorites, even if the poster's not something I'm necessarily crazy about. So I have a total of 31 movie posters in my living room. They're not original 27 by 40 one sheets, even though I do have a collection of those. They're 11 by 17, very compact, very neatly framed and spaced out equally amongst one another in the living room. It's very attractive. So here are the titles that I have surrounding me: The Assassination of Richard Nixon, Casino, The Insider, Badlands, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Hardcore, Carrie, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Cobra, and of course Cobra's there, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the initial one that came out with him standing at the opening of the cave with the machete.
That's a great one.
And talk about negative space, the poster for the 25th Hour, which is the star in red and black. Fire Walk With Me, Accidental Tourist, Last Tango in Paris, the version of Last Tango in Paris that also uses negative space, with the silhouette of Brando leaning back on the chair.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's beautiful, yeah. Scarecrow, Cuckoo's Nest, Dog Day, Blowout, The Tenant, 8.5, Thomas Crown Affair remake, Tree of Life, Clean and Sober, Heat, which had a series of very attractive kind of blue and gray posters, JFK, Vicky Cristina, Wild at Heart, Eyes Wide Shut, Taxi Driver, and then all along in a row on one wall I have Five Easy Pieces, Chinatown, and The Shining. Chinatown. Another example of a great piece of illustrative work that just exudes like 40.
Yeah, that's Jim Pearsall did that. That's probably my third favorite. That's my third favorite movie poster of all time. I think, and most people would say yes, that's one of the greats.
Let me tell you, the chills that I got a couple of years ago when that, I guess it was 74. Well, it would have to be 74. Somebody posted a picture that they took of the Chinatown billboard on Hollywood Boulevard. The opening weekend.
Yeah.
Just
I remember
huge billboard
that.
with that art on it. Oh my God! I wanted to live in that picture. Like, what I wouldn't give to go back to that time and place and be there for galvanizing movement when those movies were opening.
Yeah.
Well, they have to, and that brings up a good point. I mean, a movie poster has to, when you look at it, if it works really well, it has to evoke the great positive memories you have of that movie experience.
Well, what's interesting about a movie poster is that I always have two experiences with a movie poster when I'm, let's say I'm going to see something let's just say it's going to be a great movie or whatever. I have the experience of looking at the movie poster before seeing the movie and wondering what this portends. And then I have the experience of coming out afterwards and looking at the movie poster fondly, already remembering how great the film is, and then the poster actually resonates in a different way when you come out of the film. I think that's really the sign of a great movie poster is one of those things that's just sort of intangible kind of thing that happens before and after you see the film. You know?
And Jerry, you always loved The Godfather 3. You posted that picture of
I have that framed in my room.
Good one. That's the teaser poster for Godfather 3, which is Pacino sitting in the chair and it's gold embossed, and that's a beautiful poster. It's much better than the final poster that they came out with, the profile of Pacino's face with his hands up to his mouth like he's in prayer. I do love that poster. You know, and I had Coppola sign a Dracula teaser poster, which was just the image of the doorknob on the front of Dracula's door, and the rest of it was all black. He signed that for me, and I was always crazy about this poster for a movie that's not very good, the remake of DOA that came out in 1988.
Right.
because the story of that movie, of course, is Dennis Quaid has been poisoned and he has so many hours to live and he's trying to find the person that killed him before he dies. And so it's Dennis Quaid all sweaty and disheveled standing up against a clock and his arms make the arms of the clock, which I always loved that image. I thought, oh, and there's, and speaking of a movie that you're fond of, Jerry, The Two Jakes. Now, I know the original.
That was a great poster, too. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I know the original poster of that movie. I know that image. But there was a teaser that I only saw in advertisements, and I saw it when I opened up a Premiere magazine months before the movie came out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was Jack Nicholson sitting at his desk, but you didn't see
that. That's
Jack
a
Nicholson
great poster.
All you saw was his shoes, like, resting up on his desk. And the tagline says it's been 20-some-odd years since Chinatown, but Jake Giddey's is not forgotten. And you saw the smoke kind of rising from the ashtray on his desk. It was such a beautiful, elegant poster that I never saw again.
You're right about that. That was a terrific poster. I remember that. But that brings us to talking about teaser posters. And in compiling my list for Filmicability, I included some teaser posters in there, but if I were to be truthfully honest, these days, most all teaser posters are 1,000 times better than the actual poster for the movie. They don't have any credits on them usually and stuff like that, and I miss that, and that's okay, but that's what makes them teaser posters. But if teaser posters, if actual movie posters rose to the quality of their teasers, then we would be talking a completely different game about where movie posters are now. Because, for instance, you know, one of the teaser posters that made it on my list was the poster for Oliver Stone's W, which basically just shows a photo of Josh Brolin as the president. And he's looking down, and he's being made up by a whole bunch of people, and there's microphones coming in and everything. Mm-hmm. It's not his full – you can't see his full face or anything like that. It just says W down at the bottom. And I said, now that's a movie poster. That's awesome. When you get to the real movie poster of W, it's just a picture of him in the Oval Office with his feet up on the desk or whatever. You know, it's not as memorable or whatever.
Well,
I'm even going back to something like
teaser posters.
What now?
Teaser posters. I mean, one of the greatest teaser posters, regardless. I mean, the final film is a mess. But let's not forget The Phantom Menace. That thing of Jake Lloyd walking in the tunneling sand and the silhouette of Darth Vader. I mean, sadly, we don't get anything that great in a film, but that's a great image, regardless.
A thousand times better than the actual movie. And that's
better than the actual trilogy.
That's what's great about a lot of posters for movies. And we talk about it in this conversation about Drew Struzan, because he would design what the movie wanted to be. As opposed to what the movie actually was. What is the ideal of this movie? And so it became irresistible, and that's why those images became so iconic of posters that he made like Back to the Future and Indiana Jones and the Star Wars Return of the Jedi and the Goonies and all on and on and on. All the stuff that he drew was like the perfect version of the movie. It just captured what the movie wanted to be.
Not in great condition because I had it up on my wall for a long time. I have a Revenge of the Jedi poster.
Yeah.
Well, that's the poster that started my collection, you know. I bought it real early, weeks and weeks before, right when it came out, basically. And my poster purveyor said, hey, I got this in. And I said, oh, I'll go ahead and get it. It's only $15 or whatever. So I bought it. It was, you know, real. It was rolled and everything. And then, of course, you know, then the word came down that it had been changed. And instantly the price of my poster went up. And I went to a poster convention and traded it in for 40 more movie posters. I liked better, but I like the movies better.
Look at the teaser poster for Unforgiven. which is Clint Eastwood with his back towards you, holding a gun behind his back. That's all the movie poster shows you. It's beautiful. Do you have only U.S. one sheets on your list, or do you have any foreign designs? Because some of the foreign designs for U.S. films are actually more interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I just kept it down to the American one sheets with a few exceptions, because I really wanted this to be kind of, wanted the article to be kind of a guide for people to, these are the posters that, you know, you can buy pre-made movie poster frames or whatever. You don't have to spend $300 on a poster frame. And you can just go ahead and get the poster and put it right on in, you know. So that's kind of what my idea. But you know, French and German posters are varying sizes. Polish posters, Polish posters are just almost always incredible, like just utterly unbelievable. So they really have great artists working on those. And if I were to do that, it would have taken me a lot longer to do the piece. And so I just wanted to focus on the Americans. But that's not to say, you know, but like a French movie poster, some of them are like huge, like wall size. And so it's like you couldn't even get that framed. So I once had one for Fanny and Alexander, which is one of my favorites. And it was literally like, you know, as tall as I am, you know, so I couldn't even get a frame for it. I had to get it just mounted on foam core.
There's also, I mean, I want you to name a few of the posters on your list, and we're not going to go through all 200 of them, obviously, but just a few. But I also want to bring up the taglines for movie posters, because those go a long way. Those might actually be the most important element of selling a movie to you. And, you know, I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at a couple of posters now, you know, Chainsaw, who will survive and what will be left of them. Oh, my God. I mean, that's quite an enticing tagline. And then you look at Badlands. Here's the text on Badlands. It's like a mini book. He was 25 years old. He combed his hair like James Dean. People who littered bothered him. She was 15. She took music lessons and could twirl a baton. She wasn't very popular at school. For a while, they lived together in a treehouse. In 1959, she watched while he killed a lot of people. That's the tone of the movie, very succinct.
That's like, poetic. Detail-oriented, you know. That's great. I mean, you know. That's definitely like a poster copy like that is definitely a lost art form. Like, you know, you can kind of get like a good tagline every once in a while, just like, you know, in space no one can hear you scream and that kind of thing. But or look closer for American Beauty. But that kind of thing, that's very rare now.
It's
very,
hard to
very rare.
It's hard to encapsulate, and this is something I don't feel that filmmakers are good at. Like, filmmakers aren't good at explaining their own movies, I don't think, in general. Explaining them in terms of, this is what the movie means. Sometimes they're the last person you want to ask that question, because they're no good at explaining it. But there's writers, the best writers know how to take their thoughts and shave it down to the very simplest, most essential description. And so you get it in one line. The best songwriters do that. Springsteen does that. That's why his music is profound without being pretentious, because he just gets the essence of what he's saying in a line. Yeah, and sometimes they do that, and it's very clever. Like the tagline for True Lies, I always liked. It was kind of corny, but the tagline was, "When he said I do, he never said what he did." And that's the movie. That's snappy
pretty good.
And clever. Yeah, that does the job. Yeah.
I think you really hit on something very interesting there when you said that the directors are not the people necessarily to go to explain their movies, and that might be the reason why a lot of movie advertising is relegated to the advertising companies because maybe the director doesn't want to encapsulate the movie in an image or in a tagline or anything like that. Maybe they're too close mm-hmm. to it to do that. So they might actually breathe a sigh of relief when they finally relegate that responsibility over to the advertising companies in some way.
Yeah. Okay,
but,
so give me how do you want to do it? I mean, just give me 10.
Yeah, I'll do the top 10, you know, or top 15 maybe. I mean, you know, 15 for me is I think this is a re-release poster, but there's a great re-release poster of Rear Window that was done, and I think this looks like it might have been done in the 60s, actually. And just a beautiful, beautiful shot of some windows and what's going on inside those apartments, and then, you know, Stewart and with his binoculars at the bottom. That's just great. The original Taxi Driver movie poster by Guy Pielart, which they actually, the recent issue of Film Comment actually did a, on their final page, did a little piece on Guy Pielart and his poster art. He's kind of been forgotten in some ways, but they remembered him. But that Taxi Driver poster of Travis Bickle outside of the cab, and it's painting and it's nighttime and everything with the yellow at the bottom, it's just absolutely great. I mean, most people
know the
photo.
Movie. You know, sells the movie in that it shows you, and that's, you know, you're right. I mean, that's an artist illustrated poster. That movie shows you everything you need to know about the movie. It shows you the violence that's about to boil over. It shows the kind of
without a gun in it, by the way. He's not holding a gun. Travis Bickle isn't holding a gun in it.
It shows you the paranoia because he's kind of looking off to the side. You know, oh, it's great.
Yeah,
great.
It definitely gives you an idea that this guy is not all there. So, mm-hmm. And that's great. And again, no tagline, no anything. One of the great movie posters hits number 13, Downhill Racer, which is Michael mm-hmm. Ritchie's movie with Robert Redford playing a skier who has questionable moral ethical problems. This is kind of a poster that comes at the end of the 60s, which is 60s for me is the greatest era for movie poster design, if you ask me, because one of the big influences in that generation was the Warner Brothers 7 Arts. Warner Brothers, you know, merged with 7 Arts for a little while in the 60s, and 7 Arts is now gone and swallowed up or whatever, but I guess 7 Arts brought in a certain kind of quality to their poster design, because when you look at a 7 Arts poster design, you absolutely know, oh my God, this was made by these people. You know, they just have a tremendous hold on. They primarily use photography and actual images from the movie, but they treat the photography and they use blocks of color and very unusual logo designs. They did the posters for things like Cool Hand Luke and Rachel and Once You Kiss a Stranger and all sorts of great movies. There's an excellent website out there called Obscure One Sheet, and they did an article about Warner Brothers 7 Arts, and they did a compendium of all the ones that they could find, I guess. And when you look at this, you go, oh, my God, these are all amazing, even if you've never heard of the movie, you know. But Downhill Racer, while not being a 7 Arts movie poster, it really feels like one. It's beautiful shot of two people kissing at the top, and then it's kind of torn in half, and the tear makes it look like snow. The thing is almost all white. Even the photo looks almost white, snowy white. and then you see a real tiny figure of the skier, you know, at the top of the snow, and the tagline is, how fast must a man go to get from where he's at? Again, you know, then I go to number 12, and it's the Rain People, Francis Ford Coppola's movie from 69. This was designed by Warner Brothers 7 Arts. And it's just one of the most gorgeous, the number one movie poster I want for my collection. Just the most gorgeous movie poster, one of the best I've ever seen. Just a shot of two people kissing. You can't see who they are. And there's like a piece of glass in front, and it's got rain falling on it. And the tagline is, rain people are very fragile. One mistake in love and they dissolve. Just great. The original poster for Lawrence of Arabia with Lawrence, you know, bathed in darkness, even though he's completely out in the sun. That one's superb. Then we get into the top 10, Lost Highway, which is designed by Bernice Balkin, but it looks like something, it absolutely looks like something that Lynch would have designed himself. And I'm sure Lynch probably had a hand in this. He doesn't let anything go by, really, I don't think, without putting his hand in. But just that weird shot, it like takes that 90s trend of cutting people's faces in half, like, and putting it on the poster, you know, which was sort of started by Silence of the Lambs in some ways. But it takes that and puts it over to his side, literally, and just includes the bottom halves of the two stars, the bottom half of their faces. So the top is Bill Pullman's, you know, scraggly-looking beard and everything, and then the bottom is Patricia Arquette's, you know, sort of glamour shot.
Do you think it was done that way because the characters in the movie are split?
Yes.
Do you think that
I do.
That thinking went behind it?
I do. I mean, because the split goes right into just even looking at the logo with almost each of the letters are split as well. So the Lost Highway logo has, you know, little lines going through each one of the letters. So yes, definitely the splitting off of the personalities definitely has an effect on that. And so that's what I'm talking about. You know, like you get something of the story looking at this, you know, even though you might not really know what it is, but when you come out and you look at it and you go, oh, wow, this poster's even better than I thought it was, because it really does encapsulate the movie. Number 9 on my list is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, another great Warner Brothers design. You are cordially invited to George and Martha's for an evening of fun and games. And it has a little asterisk, and it says, important exception, no one under 18 will be admitted unless accompanied by his parent at the bottom. But again, another great movie poster design, beautiful two colors, that's it, and a real interesting use of actual photography of the stars, but done in a way that's not boring, you know. It really gets the sort of the clashing of the sensibilities in that movie down. Of course, number 8 had to be Rosemary's Baby, one of the greatest movie posters ever.
I agree.
Talk about a great. I mean, this poster has everything. It has the great tagline, "Pray for Rosemary's Baby." It has the picture of the star, but done in a very unusual, haunting way. A picture of the baby carriage, that sort of green kind of quality to it, that's beautiful, great use of negative space, very elegant design of the credits at the bottom, just beautiful. Another one that's designed by Bernice Balkin, who did the Lost Highway poster. I think this is a teaser poster, but I know that when I went to go see this in the theater in 1981, Warren Beatty's Reds, that this was the movie poster that was hanging up. And it's really simple. It's just a shot of John Reed hugging Louise Bryant at the end of the movie with just the title of the movie, Reds, at the bottom, and a big black border. I still have this poster, and it's one of my favorites. It's, like, printed on real thick cardstock. And that's also something, you know, like the stock that the movie posters are on is very important, like when you get into collecting. Like sometimes the older movie posters are cheap or from cheaper organizations are like kind of on flimsy paper, but sometimes you get them and they're on real thick cardstock and those are
wonderful. Well, here's my problem with the old movie posters, certainly not from a design element, but I wish they wouldn't have been folded because they used to fold them and ship them to theaters before they got wise and thought, oh, well, they're more preservable and they look better presentation-wise if we just ship them rolled. You know, I worked with a theater manager, and I said, they used to ship these things folded. And he was like, why the hell would they do that? And I was thinking, yeah, why the hell would they do that? You know,
well,
it was
cheaper.
Yeah.
Probably. That was the big thing. I mean, they probably had to get to some kind of industrial design, you know, sort of leaps in industrial design to get a machine that could make rolled posters as cheaply as they do, obviously, now. So that's probably the reason that happened. But I love both of them. Folded movie posters, I like because I like the folds. I don't know. I just have something. It's probably just nostalgia, but I kind of like the folds in them. I also like folded movie posters because they're easier to store. Storing rolled posters is very, very difficult. I mean, I've got 200 of them here, but I don't have 200 rolled tubes for them, you know. So I have in each tube maybe about, I don't know, 30 posters rolled up in those tubes, you know. And it's very difficult to go through them and so forth. So yeah. It's easier for me to look at folded movie posters. I just like that better as a collector. But I agree, those rolled movie posters do look sometimes incredibly stunning. Number six on my list is One for Three Women, which is one of the most insanely great movie posters
ever. I love that poster, yeah.
Unbelievable. The photography is I wish I had the photographer's name. Her name is it's a female photographer. Her name is listed on the poster. I used to have this poster, but I sold it or gave it away to somebody or something, which was stupid. I wish I had it back. This is a great, incredible poster, which has three images on it, treated photographs of each of the characters in the movie. The credits are listed in a very unusual way on the left-hand side of the poster. And then on the right-hand side of the poster, above each of the pieces, each of the photos is a little diary entry that's written by, I think it's written by the Sissy Spacek character. But it might be the Shelley Duvall character. And maybe it's both of them because their personalities do get confused in the movie. But that is just one of the most unbelievable movie posters I've ever seen. No, I've never seen anything like it, ever. Number five is, of course, Saul Bass's Anatomy of a Murder, which basically changed movie posters forever, made in 1959. Almost looks like a Mark Rothko painting in some ways. Just two big blocks of color and the Bass image of a dead body with the logo inside the dead body, and not much of a tagline. Last year's number one bestseller, this year's number one motion picture, but just unbelievable. You know, that and Man with the Golden Arm, which was also done for Otto Preminger by Saul Bass. Those two movie posters changed the entire industry. Number four would be John Alvin's poster for Blade Runner, 1982. I mean, everybody loves that movie poster, one of the most coveted movie posters of all time. John Alvin's interesting. You know, Alvin, you would be surprised to know that Alvin did the posters for Cobra, for Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, and about, but he has this art style that's like, it's hard to peg down. Like, you know, it's like, I'm always surprised when I see, oh, he did this. Wow, he really changes up his style quite a bit, you know. So I think that's really commendable. But, yeah, the Blade Runner poster is just insane. Chinatown is at number 3. And then the top 2 for me are both by the same artist, Bob Peake, who I would say maybe arguably, you know, along with Saul Bass and Drew Struzan, might be the greatest movie poster artist of all time. But my top 2 posters of all time, I mean, and Bob Peake, you know, you can go on IMDb and look up, well, I wish you could put in his name and look it up, but you could put in one of these movies, and then his name will be at the bottom as the designer, and you can click on that and see a lot of his other movie poster designs. They'll all come up. And you can do that with Drew Struzan as well. Pennies from Heaven from 81, that incredible image that just really just gives you the feeling of the entire movie in that one image. It's a dark movie, but it also has moments of brightness that is not really real, and it's really coming from another world, really. I just can't tell you how much I love this Pennies from Heaven movie poster. I'm so glad I still have my copy. And then my number 1 pick is Petulia, his poster for Petulia, which is just when you, I have this movie poster too, and it's one of the ones that I would never give up. And when you have it hanging up, I mean, you can just look at it endlessly. It's just this sort of kind of a, it almost looks like an optical illusion of the mixture of Julie Christie and George C. Scott and the other characters inside their joined bodies, and their hands are clasped at the bottom and of the image, and you can see, you know, Richard Chamberlain in there, and other characters in the film, Shirley Knight, and so forth. Just an unbelievable movie poster. It's just like, actual art, you know, like should be hanging up in a gallery. But
well,
I mean,
so much of his stuff was. I mean, his probably his most iconic. Would you say his most iconic is Apocalypse Now?
Yes, Apocalypse Now is probably the one that's probably hanging up in a lot of people's, you know,
dorms,
homes or whatever. you know, also he did Excalibur and some of the Star Trek movies. Equus, Superman, another great one. Missouri Breaks, did a couple of Bond posters, Spy Who Loved Me, Rollerball, Silverado, even going back, he had a very interesting, did a lot of musicals early on, so My Fair Lady and Thoroughly Modern Millie, Camelot, and those were much brighter. But then in the 70s, he gets a little bit darker. But he's absolutely one of the greats.
Yeah, well, you can read and see examples. I mean, he has photos of each poster. You can read all 200 of Dean's picks at his filmicability.blogspot.com, and that's some good browsing, because anything that comes complete with pictures is fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
You came up with a stunningly great involved list, and I think there's going to be a lot of stuff for movie geeks to savor when they visit that page. So we encourage everyone to do that. All right, this is a good segue for our guest interview of the evening. Eric Sharkey is the director of a great new documentary on the life and work of Drew Struzan. Like a lot of artists, he's not he prefers to be kind of behind the scenes and a little bit more of a recluse. But this is a great forum where he's in the movie, and he talks very candidly about his collaborations with filmmakers like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis and on and on and on, the great defining iconic movie posters that he's created. There's a wonderful interview with Michael J. Fox in the movie and a wonderful interview with Harrison Ford. And they feel deeply indebted to the work of Drew Struzan and feel that his work meant a lot to the success of their careers. And that's hard to argue when you see these posters. The movie is now available on DVD. It's called Drew, the Man Behind the Poster. Highly recommended. Buy it for the movie geek in your life, whether it be yourself or someone else this holiday. Here is Eric to talk all about it.
There is one artist for every couple of decades that encapsulates what film experience was for a couple of generations. And I think for my generation and the generation right before me, Drew Struzan was the movies.
His posters are modern day classics. That's not an opinion, it's a statement of fact.
It's not just an ad, you know, it's the first notes of the piece. It's the beginning of the story.
He's a storyteller, and that's what makes him very unique and ranks him with the great poster artists of all time.
I like Chewbacca on this one, too. You can even make Wookiees look good.
It's got a wet nose. That's all you need.
You get the whole movie in looking at that one image.
And this one image really made you want to run out and see that movie.
I had to almost live up to the art that we later were going to ask Drew to create for the poster.
You've been very good to me. Very good to me.
His art creates incentive nostalgia for something that you've never been introduced to before.
Masters of the Universe? I want to see this movie.
If somebody took the trouble of painting it that good, it must be worth it.
I probably never will see this movie.
They say I could draw before I could talk. It's just what I do. It's what I've always loved to do.
It's so tactile, and that's because he paints. He doesn't keyboard.
He knows every trick on the board.
He has a very distinct line.
I often pose as a youth myself.
Whatever makes you look like that, I want that shit around me.
That abstract texture, it's the merging of all those elements.
All those things add up to a feeling.
I just pick those things and make that feeling.
I'm a big fan of this person.
It's beautiful work.
He's one of the kind.
He's an original.
He's amazing.
He's part of a movie experience.
You're going to get Drew Struzan to your poster. It's almost worth making movies just for that.
I guess the first thing I'm curious about is obviously you were a big fan of Drew's work, but what set you on the journey to actually make a film about him?
I am a huge fan of his. I grew up on all those iconic posters, and when I was a kid, I always felt a connection to that artwork, and not only was advertising movies I was excited about, but I felt like the poster itself told its own story. And so when I eventually made my own feature film for the first time, I made this campy comedy starring Adam West. It was called Sexina Popstar PI, like that's how campy it was. But I actually asked Drew to do the artwork for the poster. Of course, I was assuming, well, there's no way he'll do it because he's done artwork for, you know, Spielberg and Lucas and all these great directors and films. But to my surprise, he actually made my dream come true and did the artwork for my film. So that's how I first got in touch with him. And after that experience, I wanted to know more about this person. I wanted to know more about Drew and his art. And I was actually looking online for feature-length documentaries about him, and I couldn't find any. So I just felt like, well, I want to make this movie. If someone hasn't made this yet, this is a movie I want to see. And luckily, when I contacted him about doing it, I shared, you know, the idea with the producer of the film, Charles Ricciardi, and we gave him a call, and I was very honored that in that first call he said, sure, go ahead and make the movie.
Wow. So he wasn't hesitant at all.
No, which really surprised me because Drew is a very he's a very private person. He's not someone who seeks out attention or the spotlight. I mean, I think it comes through in the movie that he really mostly just wants to be alone in his studio painting. But to my surprise, he said yes. And what was amazing was a couple weeks later, he basically told us, hey, I talked to George Lucas, and he said he'd be in the film, and you can interview him in a couple weeks if you'd like. And then all of a sudden, it was like, you know, wow, we really have to make this movie now. Like, this is happening. We got to get on this, you know. And once we started, all the dominoes started falling, and then we were able to get Spielberg and Harrison Ford and Michael J. Fox and this amazing group of interviews for the film.
So was there, I mean, he was perfectly willing to participate, but did he express to you anything in particular that he wanted the film to do or to include?
Well, I think for him, the thing that got him excited was hearing other people talk about his artwork. I think for him, it's uncomfortable to do interviews. He's not someone who likes to talk about his art. He'd rather have his art speak for itself. But I know for a fact that it was an amazing experience for him to hear what George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and Harrison Ford and, you know, Guillermo, all these people talk about his work, why they like his work, get in depth about why they hire him and love his artwork. It because they don't talk to him like that in their casual conversations. So I think for him it was amazing to hear what all these people had to say. That was his favorite part. I think for him, you know, especially when we watched the movie theatrically, I think for him to see his head like 30 feet high on a screen isn't his favorite thing. But I think he loves art, and he loves that this movie promotes his art and celebrates, you know, this amazing career he's had.
Absolutely. Tell me what, I mean, he's really the only movie poster artist that I'm aware of, and I think it's because, well, first of all, movie poster artists are, most artists are kind of in the background. You know their work, but you probably don't know their names. But
yeah,
and a lot of it has to do with the high-profile films that he was responsible for doing the artwork on. But
yeah,
where was movie poster art prior to Drew? What was that landscape like?
Well, back, you know, way back when, you know, before digital technology, for the most part, advertising, not just for films, but for the in every aspect of advertising, was mostly illustration. I mean, you had photographic stuff too, but, you know, when I was growing up, the cover of TV Guide was illustrated. All kinds of advertisements were drawn and painted. And, I mean, I grew up in an era of illustrators that I really loved, like Bob Peak or Frazetta, who's famous for doing all the Conan the Barbarian stuff, or you had like guys like Mobius, who did all this work for heavy metal. I mean, I was always drawn to illustration. But Drew is really the last great master of that era, and I think the reason why his work is so identifiable and more recognizable than a lot of illustrators is not just the content like Star Wars or Indiana Jones, but there's a connection that you have with his particular style. I mean, when I tell people I made this film, I say it's about Drew Struzan, they go, I don't know who that is. And I say, oh, he painted the Back to the Future poster. You automatically get that image in your head from that poster. It's so identified with the film. And I think, I mean, I'm a lover of illustration, and Drew's always been my favorite. And I think he's really the last of this generation to continue to work and have high profile stuff. I mean, nothing's illustrated anymore. It's all Photoshop. It's all digital. And for my taste, I don't think movie posters are as beautiful as they used to be.
That's absolutely true. And I was so thankful that is a prominent section in your film where you discuss the changing nature of movie poster art and how it isn't valued anymore, and it's all done like everything else in filmmaking. It's all done by committee now.
Yeah, I mean, back then, you went to a Drew Struzan because you loved his style. You loved the way he painted. You wanted what he brought to it, and there was a lot of work in terms of finalizing the image before you went into the poster. Now, because of digital technology, I think they just want to make 5,000 changes because they can. And it's unfortunate that someone like Drew paints and draws, you know, he can't do 5,000 changes or comps. He's a human being. But I think there's something missing because of all that committee, because there's so many cooks in the kitchen. I think you're missing that true interpretation through a master artist that's his take on the movie. And I think his work speaks for itself. I mean, it's beautiful, and it's so identified with the films.
And there's also a segment of your film where you show his non-movie-related, non-commissioned artwork, and it's absolutely stunning. And I wanted to know from you if you ever got a sense from him that if he ever felt creatively stifled to kind of bring to life someone else's vision.
Well, you're right that he has this amazing fine art that he does now that is really incredible. And he says in the film one of the hard things about the job is to take all these different ideas and contractual obligations that the studio has and everything and make it look like a piece of art where he did what he wanted. I think now he has a freedom to paint whatever he wants, and I think he loves expressing himself in that way. But I also think he loved the challenge of it, of taking all these different elements and parameters and things people wanted and turning it into an amazing piece of art. And he definitely was inventive. I mean, he created compositions, especially, I think, with, like, the Temple of Doom poster, which I think is one of the great ones. He invented sort of a style and and use of composition and portraiture that ended up getting copied a lot. So I think it caused a lot of inventiveness for him, actually, to have to work in that industry.
Yeah. And how do you do – you do a great job of kind of every participant does a great job of describing what distinguishes his work. And it's interesting because there's – I mean, it seems from a distance very photorealistic, the faces on his posters. But upon closer inspection, you see, I mean, you see the brushstrokes and the pencil lines. I mean, it's obviously amazingly, meticulously crafted artwork.
Yeah, I mean, I think his work is fine art. Even though it's for film advertising, it's true art. And you're right, when you get up close to it, you can see all this texture. He doesn't make it perfectly clean. He lets you see the brush strokes. He lets you see the colored pencil. He lets you see the work underneath it. I mean, one of the cool things about seeing the film, especially like in the theater, was seeing how big his artwork is. You could really lose yourself in these paintings. I mean, one corner of a Drew Struzan poster is like its own painting. It's its own world because there's so much going on. And just like a lot of the fine artists, from far away, you know, it looks perfect, and you get up close, and you say, oh, okay, there's not as much detail as you would think there would be, because from far away, it looks photoreal.
Mm. What's also fascinating about him is he never even considered movie poster art until the first opportunity to do a piece came to him. Is he a movie aficionado?
Well, that's one of the funniest things for making the movie for me was that I assumed that he must have grown up the way I did in terms of, like, loving movies and loving comic books and Mad Magazine and all this sort of pop culture stuff. But he's not into that stuff, really. I mean, growing up, he was into fine art. He wasn't somebody who was a movie geek like us, and it's amazing how many posters he's done for movies that he's never seen, actually. I mean, he told me he just saw The Thing, which is a famous poster of his. He just saw the movie for the first time, like, a year or two ago. And he was actually like, yeah, I know. And he was actually like, hey, that's a good movie. And I was like, yeah, it came out like 30 years ago. It was a great movie, you know. But it's amazing that he can interpret sort of the spirit of the movie. He even says it's not about just interpreting just like what happens in the movie. It's like the whole tone and spirit of the movie. So even though he hadn't seen the movie The Thing, he still was able to paint this incredible portrait that sort of represents the tone of how scary the movie is going to be. But yeah, it is amazing he didn't grow up on a lot of this stuff. I mean, there are certain things he feels more passion towards, especially sort of like Star Wars or Indiana Jones. I mean, I did have a great geek moment with him at San Diego Comic-Con where we were standing together and somebody walked by dressed as Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. And he kind of looked and said, oh, that's that wizard guy from Lord of the Rings, right? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, Obi-Wan could kick his ass, you know? And I was like, oh, great. You know, like I had this geek moment with Drew because that doesn't happen often, you know?
Wow. So you get, in terms of his process, if actually seeing the movie wasn't of paramount importance, I guess having a conversation with the filmmaker and to know exactly what they were after or the tone that they were after was something that he considered before he drafted any poster?
Well, certain filmmakers give him more access than others. So there are certain times where the director would have a talk with him, would be involved in the making of the poster. There are other times where he actually had seen the film in advance, so he knew what the film was about. But there were a lot of jobs where he got a synopsis and just basically production stills, and that was all he had. And he had to sort of tell the story of the movie based on that. I mean, I know First Blood was one where he was just given like a paragraph synopsis and some stills, you know. But he's able to, with very little information, sort of pull you into the essence of the movie. He always says what's important is sort of the essence of the film, but, you know, what the overall story is about, what the core of it is, you know, and I think he captures that beautifully, especially like something like Back to the Future, where he tells the whole story in this one image of him looking at his watch. It tells you the tone of the movie. It gives you a mood, but that's not a scene in the movie. That never happens in the actual movie. And in the film, even stuff like Big Trouble in Little China, you know, even says there's a lot of things that aren't in the actual film, but it's not about that specifically. It's what's the tone of it, and he sort of captures the overall tone in an amazing way.
Yeah, he captures, especially with that movie, I mean, he captures the adventurous spirit of it. And of course, in something like Temple of Doom, I actually have Temple of Doom hanging in my living room. It's one of my all-time favorite posters and one of my all-time favorite movies. So for you personally, I mean, you've mentioned a couple of them, but what other posters come to mind that you count as favorites?
Well, there's so many. I mean, especially in making this film, I thought I'd seen a lot of Drew's artwork being a fan, but there's constantly stuff people are showing me that I've never seen before, so it's kind of incredible how much output came out of one guy. But I mean, there was a period where I was growing up where it was literally like, it was like, okay, Big Trouble in Little China, Back to the Future, The Goonies, even comedies, even like Adventures in Babysitting, you know, or Cannonball Run, or you know, my personal favorites are related to Indiana Jones and Star Wars. I really love that Temple of Doom poster too. I had that one hanging on my wall. And I really love his Return of the Jedi teaser poster, which I think is really, really beautiful.
Is that the one? That's the one you show in the film, the red with the Vader.
Yeah, Darth Vader and Luke and him fighting. And it's interesting as we get into in the film, he painted them the wrong colors, so all these Star Wars fans sort of boys are reading into it why Luke has the red lightsaber.
You know, it's also interesting that he's particularly fond of his work on the Police Academy franchise, those posters. So I mean, some of his – and that called to mind that, you know, I mean, the Police Academy films definitely have their place, but some of the best artwork doesn't necessarily come from the best films. I mean, they're not always synonymous.
That's true. I mean, Drew's job is to bring out the best in a movie and try to and sort of celebrate the spirit of it. But sometimes the movie itself is not the best movie. I mean, one of the films we get into in the documentary is Masters of the Universe. How if you see that poster, you think, oh my God, this movie is going to be awesome, you know? And there's a lot of movies that don't live up to how beautiful his artwork is. I mean, his job is to paint a beautiful painting. And something like Cutthroat Island is a beautiful, stunning poster, but it's not a film I particularly liked. But if, damn, if it didn't have an amazing piece of art to go with it. So I think
it
Drew,
really
yeah. I mean, so there's often times where Drew's artwork is better than the film itself. Yeah. You know?
Well, and the artwork is really the ideal of what you hope that movie will be too. And there's something about his artwork that more than anyone else, it brings to mind, you know, the very childlike enthusiasm and excitement about movies. I mean, it inspires that in you.
Well, yeah, and there's also the way he captures a character. Like, and Harrison Ford talked about this in the documentary about how the way he captures Indiana Jones. I mean, it's more than just a painting that looks like Indiana Jones. It's like it is Indiana Jones. You can see behind the eyes. It's like his painting is a performance. You get everything about that character in that portrait, and I've seen other artists try to copy that in other Indiana Jones work, but there's always something missing. It just doesn't have that magic that Drew can do with that character.
Yeah, there's a great segment of the film where he attends Comic-Con, and I was curious, has he been aware, or was he aware prior to going to Comic-Con, just how much movie fans idolized him?
Well, I think Drew always knew that he had a place in the industry because he kept getting hired, and his stuff would be out there. But, you know, he used to be in the papers or be on billboards. But he never really knew the impact that it had to, like, movie geeks like me or, like, to the greater culture. I mean, he really was alone in his studio just painting around the clock. He knew the illustrators were being inspired by it, but he didn't think the average person was really being drawn to this or how future filmmakers were being inspired by it. So it didn't really happen until the internet. The internet is when he first started getting a realization that, wow, I have some fans out there. There's interest in my work, but Comic-Con, I think, is really where someone like a Drew Struzan is like a rock star. You know, that's the one place where they really celebrate great art and these films. You know, so when he goes there, I think he is overwhelmed by the sort of affection and how popular his artwork is. And I think he's still kind of surprised by it, but as you'll see in the film, I mean, you go to Comic-Con and there's so much love for him and his work, not just from people my age who grew up on this stuff, but from teenagers. They weren't even alive when Star Wars and Indiana Jones came out, but they're discovering this artwork and they feel a real connection to it. So he's reaching that new generation, that next generation.
And of filmmakers as well. I mean, you have Mr. Darabont and Del Toro represented in the film, and they completely idolize the man, and they hire him for every project they have. And Del Toro, the studio never approved one of Drew's posters from his films, but he still commissions them because he's so enamored with them.
Well, that's what's such a sad thing right now, is that illustration is so out of fashion that even a legendary illustrator like Drew, a lot of times they won't use his artwork, and you have like these amazing directors like Del Toro, like Darabont, who grew up on this stuff that couldn't wait to hire Drew to do artwork. And especially in the case with Guillermo del Toro, like you were saying, you know, he did artwork for both the Hellboy movies and Pan's Labyrinth, this beautiful, beautiful artwork, and they don't use it. The studio won't use it, and Guillermo will pay for it out of his own pocket just because he wants Drew Struzan artwork associated with his film because he loves that art so much, and it's a real shame that it doesn't get used, because I mean you got to think, when a director like Guillermo del Toro can't get them to use it, I mean that says a lot about how much the industry doesn't want illustrated stuff. But at places like Comic-Con, they seek out this artwork. They would rather have Drew Struzan's Hellboy poster than the one the studio put out, and that artwork needs so much more to Guillermo, because he says, this is what I feel accurately represents my movie, not the poster that they did, you know.
When you make a film about a figure, a real-life figure as you have with Drew. I cannot imagine the nervousness of showing them your film for the first time. What was that experience like?
Getting feedback in terms of, like, from the actual film, from the people that are in it.
From Drew, I mean, because you want to do justice to Drew, and you don't want to, you want him to be happy with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously the person's opinion that mattered to me the most was Drew, because he was so kind to give us so much of his time, to, not only for these interviews, but he gave us all the artwork, all these high res scans of the artwork. He oversaw the way the artwork is used in the film. And it's been a four-year process of making the movie. And like we were just talking about, Drew is somebody who's who's an introverted person, who's you know, a private person. So I really wanted to do him justice, and I was really, really lucky that we watched the film together at San Diego at Comic-Con, and it was such a relief that he liked the film and approved of it and thought it was a really well-made movie. And then we watched it again just recently at the ArcLight Theater in Hollywood, and he said, you know, I loved it even more this time than the last time I saw it. So he's enjoying the film more and more with the more times he sees it. And I can't even tell you, for me and for everyone involved in the film, everyone involved in the making of the film, we're all Drew Struzan fans. It really means a lot to us that Drew loves the movie. The last thing I would want to do is disappoint Drew Struzan, you know, he's someone I admire so much. And even just getting feedback from other people, I was lucky enough to have a conversation with Guillermo del Toro last year, and he had seen a screener of the film with where it was then. And even he said, oh, I really loved the movie. I thought it was really well done, and I enjoyed it. And so, you know, to hear that from Guillermo, to hear this from Drew, and all the feedback we're getting, it's especially from people who see it in the theater as well, just people who are Drew fans, the fact that they love it. I mean, it means a lot, because you work so hard on something for all these years, and the last thing you want to do is screw up something like that. So.
Well, you did a beautiful job with it. I mean,
thank you.
It's a real godsend for movie fans, like rabid movie fans. And before I let you go, I want to ask you just one last question. If you could pick out, I don't know, I would imagine you're a movie poster collector of sorts.
Mm.
If you could pick out five favorite posters, whether they're Drew's posters or someone else's, which movies would they be for?
Well, obviously Drew Struzan's my favorite illustrator, but yeah, I love so many. It's actually a hard one, because there are so many. Like I was saying, I really love that Return of the Jedi teaser poster. I love Temple of Doom. I've always it's interesting, because Big Trouble in Little China is actually one of my favorite Drew Struzan posters, and yet when I interviewed him, he said that was one of his least favorite. He said he thought it was way too busy, but that's what I loved about it. But we also have great interviews with other illustrators in the film, and I love their work too. So like Hildebrandt, like he did him and his brother did the original Star Wars with Luke with the lightsaber over his head. That's like, it was such a beautiful poster. Roger Cassell, who's in the film, who did the Empire Strikes Back poster, that's sort of the Gone with the Wind one that is so beautiful, you know. And I've also always loved Bob Peake's Apocalypse Now poster with Brando. And it's amazing, because Drew Struzan is a real Bob Peake fan as well, and he's actually doing a show in L.A. and Bob Peake is passed away, but he's doing a joint show with Bob Peake's artwork through his family, which is sort of like the Beatles and the Stones getting together to do a show for me as an illustration geek.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm a huge movie poster nerd, so I actually have 31 movie posters hanging up in my living room. They're like framed, and my place is covered with them. So I'm right there with you, my friend.
The first time he had the freedom to create, to be really creative, was the Indiana Jones piece. And that's when, you know, he developed a lot of different techniques for the visual effect of the poster. And that was a really big turning point in his career.
I did one comp and sent it to him. They said, that's great, paint it. So there were no changes, no other ideas. That was straight up my idea. No interference of any kind from anybody. So I just painted it freely and with that the confidence, because I had designed it, that I could make it nice. Sent it to him, and that's what the Temple of Doom poster became. And that was the one where he said, gee, we like that design. From now on, that's indie. That is the look.
When Drew came along and started to do the work, it really made a big difference. It focused attention on that character, gave him a nobility and a heroic nature, and frankly, made me look good, you know. So I was a happy guy.
You know, that whole, you know, feeling of texture that he brings into his art, the feeling that you can almost reach out and touch it, you feel like you're going to feel the smoothness of the face of one of the heroines, Indiana Jones, you're going to feel the gruffness of the villains. It's so tactile, his art.
Okay, that was Eric Sharkey. His movie is titled Drew, the Man Behind the Poster. Pick it up now. It's available on DVD. Thank you, Eric, very much. All right, we'll be back. This Wednesday is our JFK show.
Mm.
Interesting new interviews. Sally Kirkland, Jim Mars, Joe Hutching, who won an Oscar for editing the film, and plus snippets of our past interviews with Robert Richardson, Michael Rooker, producer A. Kitman Ho. It's a packed show. And then we'll be back next Sunday with more guests and more movie talk. So that's it, guys.
All right.
Excellent.
Awesome.
All right.
Well, thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, and have a great week.